another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my very special guest, Dennis Crosby, former member of Potter's House. Dennis, it's good to have you on and to talk about Potter's House. I think you might be the very first one that has actually come on the podcast to talk about it, but I have had email conversations and I've had a few people in the comment feed, you've probably seen them, talking about the Potter's House. And anyway, it's good to have you. If you could take a moment and just introduce yourself.
Okay, my name is Dennis Crosby. I'm an American. I spent 20 years in the Army. I got out in the Netherlands. And I've been living here since 96, actually. I first ran into the Potter's House. It was called Victory Chapel in Colorado Springs when I was stationed there. And I thought it was wonderful. It was a really, really great environment. It was something I was familiar with because of my upbringing. And it just, it seemed really ideal. And I went from there. I went to Arizona in 1980. And I was in one of the churches again, and they were both very, very much the same. And I had experience when I was younger that from one church to the next is a lot of difference. But I was really impressed by the fact that they were similar to one another. And then I got sent back to Colorado Springs, and after that to the Netherlands, where they had just opened the first church in the Netherlands. And they only had one other one in Europe at the time in Germany. So it was like fresh ground here. The things that made it really different were the church services, everybody spoke in tongues. I mean, you would, especially after the certain song, it was kind of a trigger, or right before the offering, that was another trigger. But it was, it was unrestrained, and I really liked that. That to me, that was that made me feel at home. But I ended up, I got married over here, and I went back to Colorado Springs. I thought it was a little bit different. Same church. This is my third time now at that church. And then after that, I got sent to Germany. After the Gulf War, I had to turn in a lot of units, and I ended up retiring and coming back to the Netherlands. And then I started noticing, because I was stable again after, you know, moving around. I moved 8 times in 10 years toward the end, and I saw that a lot of stuff was not working out right. There were people that I had known, it seemed like they were really on fire and really part of it, that left. They were gone. And I stayed there. In the church, I tried to do my best to help out, to come up with things to help. I had decided fairly early I did not want to become a pastor. If you're in the door, that's your whole goal. You become a pastor too. They send you out. Nobody goes to Bible school, but they send you out to start a church. It's very much a hierarchy, very much a marketing kind of hierarchy, actually. And nobody has hardly any Bible knowledge at all, it seems. But it was founded, the founder, his name is Wayman Mitchell. Wayman Mitchell was in Prescott, Arizona, out of Foursquare. And I think it was 83, while I was in the Netherlands, that he split out of Foursquare. He took all the churches that were under him, which was like hundreds by that time, and they started their own thing, which is officially called Christian Fellowship Ministries. And I thought it was a little odd that we suddenly had a logo. And before, it had been a fellowship of different churches, pastors working together, that kind of thing. And suddenly it's becoming an organization with a letterhead and everything. And they started, they came up with, I didn't know this at the time, but they came up with a kind of a contract that the pastors had to sign, where they basically gave up all rights to everything, including the church, including bank accounts, including equipment. And they were required to walk away, basically, if they disagreed with the organization anymore. But I noticed something shifted, and I started noticing that people were leaving, but I was very busy in, you know, a lot of IT stuff, actually, and a lot of multimedia in the church. Subtitling Oak, also. That's, that was a big deal. And I started noticing too many people, good people, leave. And one day when we were discussing the video, one of the preachers lied to me. I knew he lied. And he did this like 3 years in a row because we were making the conference videos. So I went to the council about it and they didn't care. For them, the issue was he was a pastor. I was not. I was questioning his authority, and that was the problem. And basically, I ended up leaving. It was a few years later still, but I just completely blew up. I called the preacher everything I could, pretty much, and never went back. About 6 months later, my wife left. You don't leave. You get ostracized. And yeah, we... And then my son left. Well, actually, my oldest daughter left first, and her husband. And then my son left 3 years later.
It's like Hotel California. You can check out anytime you want, but you can never leave.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the way a lot of these groups are. Mentally, you stay bound to some of these groups. In fact, myself, I just had this conversation with a guy the other day. I can sit in a church service, and it might be the most peaceful, loving sermon that you've ever heard. Just something that's very simplistic. But all he has to do is mention that one book, chapter number, and verse number, and all the programming associated with that in my head starts to fire, and I'll just come unglued. And it's the same way for me. I can check out anytime I want, but it's really hard to leave.
Yeah.
What's really interesting about the Potter's House, and I've got this, actually had this on my list to investigate and dive deeper, because there's a lot happening here that is a spiderweb of connections to things that things that I'm investigating already. Foursquare, obviously. You've got Gordon Lindsay, who was out of Foursquare. You've got Chuck Smith out of Foursquare. You've got so many people connected to Foursquare and Branham. They were platforming Branham, tied to the Latter Rain. So there's an epicenter there. But in Prescott, Arizona, that is where Branham had his compound. And I should say Gene and Leo. Gene Goad and Leo Mercer had a very destructive compound that made national news during the time whenever it exploded and it was learned all of the abuse that was happening there. So it's a big deal. Chuck Smith also has ties to Prescott. So there's so many different spiderwebs of connection, and you can't really say that they're all linked. Like, I can't really link Potter's House and say that influenced Chuck Smith or vice versa. But there is this weird epicenter there. And from what I have come to understand is, in some of these towns, and especially the smaller towns, everybody in the Pentecostal community, even though they're in different denominations, they all tend to know each other for some reason or another. So there is a cross-pollination of ideas. And how much of that went to Potter's House, how much of it went the other direction, that's really what I want to know. And one day I plan to dig deeper into that.
Well, one thing I do know, okay, my opinion is that the founder of Potter's House, Wayman Mitchell, was basically a Chuck Smith wannabe. It's like there was this constant competition in his head because he wouldn't even mention his name. You know, if he happened to refer to something, he wouldn't say it, but you could tell there was this parallel thing going on. But actually, when you're in the Potter's House, you don't know anything about anybody. I mean, the other organization, you don't know anything. It all started when Wayman Mitchell, you know, he figured it all out and he started the movement. But I have found out, and largely through your podcast, just how much this web is connected. Yeah. My son has actually dived in pretty deep. He's busy here in the Netherlands. And he's read The Vine and Its Branches, Foursquare, and several other things to investigate that. But I haven't. I have that allergy too much.
So I'm real curious to know, inside the Potter's House, what was it like? What were the meetings like, the community? How was your experience when you're in Potter's House?
Okay. Potter's House does a lot of street preaching, on the street evangelism. They're very aggressive, actually. They also have lots of skits, lots of drama, some very good ones, I think. They also use contemporary music. I mean, like, as in hits, but they change the words. They've also been sued for Hamilton. Well, I think that's the name of it. They did a version of that, their own version, and they got sued for it. So, yeah. But the service itself is very, very revival. And lots of, you know, in tongues, speaking in tongues, which, you know, to me, that feels like a home. Actually, I've had to stop because I cannot justify it biblically, in public, actually. One of the good things I did when I left is I stopped reading translations and I went straight to Greek. I'd been working on it for years and I finally made the break, and I copied most, well, okay, Matthew, Mark, Luke, Acts, and Revelations. I have not copied, but the rest I've copied by hand in the New Testament. Yeah. And it taught me a lot. It taught me that this is not possible, what they're teaching based on this verse, because, yeah, those meanings are not here. there were a lot of things, and I'm glad I did that. I didn't realize how helpful it would be, but it got my focus good.
It is funny how many people have told me this, and myself included. If you just simply read the Bible, you would have quickly left the group because what they're saying just really doesn't match. And like you're saying, those who take it a step further and they'll go back and study the Greek and Hebrew, the meanings aren't quite the same as they preach it in some of these ministries. And when you understand the meaning, it number one, it opens up to a much more in-depth book than you thought it was to begin with.
Yeah,
but number two, it just simply doesn't match what they're saying, you know?
Yeah, and I knew that. I felt that. I caught them a couple of times preaching stuff that wasn't even in the verse. But it really opened my eyes when I just broke free. And I dived in.
One of the things that I have been, as I said, I've wanted to dig deeper into Potter's House. One of the things that I've wanted to dig into was the discipleship program. And I'm hoping you have some knowledge about that, because when you consider all of the things that happened after Branham died, especially with the shepherding movement, which was basically discipling, there was this initiative really to gain control of the people that was far beyond even what Branham himself had, I believe. And I'm trying to understand that. What was Potter's House version of discipling?
Discipleship was basically on-the-job training to become a preacher. So that's really what it was. But it was, when you actually went into, and I did not, I never took that step. But when you actually did take that step, then you were kind of like a slave to your pastor almost. You know, it could get in unreasonable. It depended on the guy. You know, it always does. But some of them were, yeah, still are, but yeah, it's unreasonable and has nothing to do with dealing with people, you know, with being a Christian even. That's one of my great objections to this whole thing is I wasted 37 years in it. And I developed a personality kind of similar to the leader. I mean, not directly, but from the environment where I'm not a very good Christian when it comes down to it. You know, I mean, I want to be, try to be, but the personality that you take on is aggressive and not, well, to say not loving is an understatement. You know, you look down on people. It's an elitist thing because you go through the trouble to take, you know, follow all these rules. There's no TV, for instance. They tried to stop internet from ever happening. You know, you're pretty cut off. The rules actually contribute to the bad personality, really. You know, and I've tried to focus on Galatians chapter 5, you know, as a target to try to get the fruit of the Spirit. You know, you have a Christ-like character. I'm a long way from that, honestly. It's sad to say I'm 70 now, you know.
Whenever you're in one of those discipleship programs, whenever you have somebody who is now becoming your authority, they get the idea that you can't question their authority. And that's usually what happens. Was that happening in Potter's house as well?
Oh yeah. That's I didn't realize it, though, because I kind of went along with everything. You know, I mean, it's they didn't have to convince me about doctrines. The only two things I disagree with is I was not 100% pre-trib when I walked in, but I was when I was there. and also, no alcohol at all. That I knew that wasn't quite right, but I went along with it. You know, I didn't have any problem with not drinking. I was even a vegetarian for 30 years, and that's not their thing. But, you know, I that was not an issue for me. But they make these rules. You follow the rules. They gossip about everybody who doesn't follow the rules that's in the church, or if they suspect it. It's a terrible environment, actually, for just being a decent human being, I think.
And another thing that seems to match where the charismatic movement was heading, and which what you said about Chuck Smith makes me wonder how much this would be the case. A lot of the charismatic style ministries, they went off into this idea that you're going to have all of these conventions and things where you're basically bringing a bunch of people together who can become new converts out of other churches. Is that something that Potter's House did as well?
Generally not. In fact, they spoke out against taking people from other churches, but they did it too. They allowed it. Actually, there was a period of time where the attitude was Calvary Chapel. Those members were people who had backslidden from Potter's House. So we were, you know, giving them members, but the reverse, people from other churches were generally considered a problem because they had other ideas. I mean, I was one of those people. And they told my son that I was a rebel and he should find another person to look up to in the church while I was in the hospital. That was like, yeah, I have an opinion about them.
The other thing about Potter's House that I'm certain is the case, a lot of the ministries that sprung off of the Foursquare, well, Pentecostalism in general, they were real heavy on the tithing. And they were pushing it to some extent. Some of the churches would actually. I talked to a guy just yesterday that one of the churches that he attended, they were actually going into the business accounts and asking him to show his revenue for the business that he owned. They literally wanted to take tithing to the level where they are monitoring how much you make and making sure they get their fair share, which is far beyond what a church should ever do. Now, this wasn't the same group that you were in, but some of these groups take it to extreme levels. How extreme would you say that Potter's House was on the tithing issue?
I have video of the founders saying, if you don't pay your tithes, you go to hell. And another preacher, too, saying the same thing. But this is later stuff, that when they start getting really extreme on that. And there's another video of the current leader, who's the son of the founder, telling people that if they were saved in the Tempe branch, which is, they have these, you know, Tempe, Arizona, they owe their soul to that church. Flat out says it, because they were doing an offering. That's why he said it. It's during the offering. And there was something, Pentecostal versus charismatic. That's an issue also in the Potter's House, because Wayman Mitchell always, the founder, always made the distinction that we were Pentecostal. We're not charismatic. We're a Pentecostal. We're a Pentecostal church. it was a big thing. And that appealed to me as well, because growing up, I had seen charismatic influence that it didn't seem right. So that pitch that he gave, that appealed to me. Later, I see a lot of that charismatic stuff in the Potter's House. So it was just a selling point.
So I'm interested, you talked about the not drinking, which is something that we shared, and it's not that unusual when you think about the Pentecostal movement, charismatic movement, but I'm curious to know how much they actually got into your personal lives, because this is a common thing, especially in the more destructive cults. They want to own your Some of them even go so far as to tell you who you can or cannot get married to. I've seen some destructive groups like this. They're very rigid on defining the gender roles. In the message cult, the cult following of William Branham, they never really preached the gender roles, but it was assumed that men did these certain tasks and women did these other tasks. And after we started attending a new church, I find myself doing all kinds of things that I never did in my life, which is good. I confess I should probably have helped out around the house a little bit more. But the churches seem to establish the boundaries that are set by the genders, and they, in essence, they invade your family life. And if you read Dr. Stephen Hassan's book, Combating Cult Mind Control, he defines the behavioral control, the information control, thought manipulation and control, and emotion manipulation. The behavior is a big part. And having spun off of the some of the groups that you've mentioned, I will say that there's a likelihood that that you experienced many of the same things that I did. How far would you say they invaded your personal life?
In my case, I didn't plan on staying in the Army 20 years, and Wayman Mitchell suggested that I do that. So I did that. My son actually left over the fact that they told him he could not marry his wife. and it wasn't just that. He was fighting with us all the time because we had left. He went from, we were kind of pillars in the church kind of thing locally. And then suddenly, son of a rebel, that's it, his chapter of the book. They told him they messed with him big time. And they told him he couldn't get married. He left and married her anyway. They've been married 7 years now. So that didn't work. But that, seeing how they responded to him, made him realize they were wrong. In spite of all our arguments, their behavior was the convincing factor. As far as the gender roles, they're real strict on that. Women can't do anything but clean up, serve, and babysit. That's about it. My wife and daughters hated it much more than I realized. I thought they went along with it, and then I get out and they start complaining. I'm like, whoa, it was a lot worse than I had imagined. But what I know now, it's ridiculous. I mean, it's absurd that you're going to subject half of humanity to that kind of treatment, and he said this over and over and over, Wayman Mitchell, it galled him that Foursquare had so many women in charge, women in positions, and he left Foursquare and there's none of that in the Potter's house.
Yeah, back to the gender roles in the women. Whenever my wife came out of this, she was pretty happy, and still, even afterwards, she doesn't really talk negatively of her experience. But I've noticed over time there were things that she didn't know bothered her, and it took her years before she started to realize that things that they forced on her just weren't right. There were things that she couldn't do that really had no relationship whatsoever to even religion or the Bible. They were just rules for the sake of rules. And I've come to learn that a lot of the groups that spun off of this mess that I'm examining, that's really all they had, rules for the sake of rules.
Yeah.
And I've thought long and hard about trying to understand why that is. Why would you want to have that? Some people will say the leader's narcissistic and they're doing it to be overbearing to the people, but I really don't think that's it. I have come to the conclusion that people in these leadership in these groups, they come up with the idea that if we can become slightly better than the church down the street, we can earn our salvation. And so really what it does is it takes salvation out of the hands of Jesus and salvation according to the Bible, and it puts it into their own version of salvation, which in effect is a different gospel.
Yeah, it's clearly, you have to stay in the good graces of your pastor. You have to do all the things, evangelism, can't have a TV, all kinds of rules that you have to, no beards. No beards. Here I am. I told them when I get out, and that's what I did. But just crazy stuff like that. That's almost the opposite of the Bible sometimes, but they've come up with this. And the way they preached early on was they called it the fellowship distinctives, the things that made us different than everybody else. And yeah, that, well, speaking in tongues was a big part of it.
And usually it almost goes hand in hand. The moment that they come up with the new set of rules that establishes the difference between us and them, and really that's what it comes down to, it's establishing boundaries. Once you set those boundaries, then comes the fear, and the fear comes through the doctrine. They will say that, you know, if you don't abide by these rules, you're bound to hell, and those people who are suffering, who are in the church down the street, and they'll just point fingers at anything they can do to give you a fear of leaving. So what it does is, the commune that I was talking about in Prescott, I think they did have a fence or something, but it wasn't like a commune when you picture Jim Jones or some of the compounds. Literally, it becomes a commune of your mind. You are just so bound by fear, it's really hard to leave. You like I said before, you can check out, but you can never leave. That is imprinted into your brain. So it turns into a gospel of fear and a gospel of guilt. And from what I've come to understand from at least the comments and the little bit that I know about Potter's House, there was a deep level of fear for some of the people who have escaped and they've talked about their leaving.
I don't have a problem with fear normally. That's not something I'm really sensitive to.
Did they encourage or discourage critical thinking?
Oh, there's, what's that?
But that's kind of what I thought. And usually that, see, you're an oddball because in the Army, they train you not to have fear. So you're an oddball as it relates to a former cult member. I think for the average cult member, the way that they indoctrinate you not to critically think is usually through boundaries made by fear. So in the minds of some of the people, that's where that heads. I know that's exactly what I had whenever I tried to leave. You have to first overcome the fear of leaving, then you overcome the critical thinking of why you're leaving, and then you leave.
Yeah, a lot of my involvement was more triggered because of guilt, because I felt really guilty about, you know, growing up in a pastor's family other than fellowship. I gave my parents a lot of flack. I mean, seriously, it was not good, and I always felt bad about that after I did become a Christian. And so when I got in the door, which seemed to me like this is the revival that's going to last till Jesus comes back, that was my impression of it at the beginning. I just did everything I could that I could dream up to help. I mean, I started their first website here in the Netherlands, and you know, things like that. I made databases for them and started a thing where everything was converted to MP3s, and you know, but I was looking for things that would help out, and I tried to assist the pastors out of, you know, guilt feelings. That's really what it was.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the Latter Rain, Charismatic, and other fringe movements into the New Apostolic Reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support. So let's talk a little bit about the relationship of the people in the church and the leadership's incentives to get involved in those relationships. Whatever I was growing up, I was watching some families who, we had a very rigid, you are not able to divorce after you have been married, And if you do, you certainly can't be remarried, which is common among a lot of the Pentecostal groups. But they took it to the next level in our group. They really instilled a fear of even getting divorced. So I watch families who were together who, the husband and wife, man, it was like tying two cat's tails together and putting them over a clothesline. They did not blend well. I'll just say it like that. And it's mostly because the church got involved too heavily in the lives. And as I mentioned earlier, sometimes they got involved in who married who, which made it all the more interesting. You had people getting married who didn't love each other in the first place. The Prescott group that I mentioned earlier, the case that went to the California Supreme Court was a child who was raised in a home where the husband was homosexual, the wife, it was basically a forced marriage, or a coerced marriage, I should probably say. So when you're in that type of environment where they're controlling your lives, it makes the family life difficult, but it also breeds mental health issues. How much did they get involved in the lives of the people as it related to their relationships?
That's quite variable. But I do know, like, that I know one case where the man was homosexual and still married a woman. That didn't work out. They would sometimes recommend that they maybe split up and get divorced if one of them left. My daughter, after I stormed out of the church, told my wife not to leave me. That was something she explicitly said when that happened. And yeah, sometimes they do. And I had never seen that before. I've seen women really suffer a lot because they stayed with their husbands. Nobody got divorced, but that happens more, I think, in the fellowship. I always attributed it to Foursquare, actually. They were a little more liberal, too.
Yeah, and the Foursquare branches, it's really odd the direction that the Branham cult went with the influence out of Foursquare, because right down to the central element, you had a female pastor, which Branham strongly condemned, and it's really odd when you think about it. But they do have a different spin on things, I think, for that very reason. The female pastor had to overcome all of the stigma that she was fighting during that era. There weren't that many that allowed it. And let's talk through that a bit. With the Foursquare influence, how much of the doctrines would you say were unique to your group, and how much were borrowed from Foursquare?
The doctrinally, they're very close to Foursquare. They even recommend Foundations of Pentecostal Theology, that was actually a Foursquare textbook. As far as doctrine goes, but the perspective is completely different. It was like anathema to think of a woman pastor. My opinion is, at this point, that it's just as much for men who are pastors, because what they have come up with and they call pastors, that is not for anybody. You know, what the fellowship has done, what Potter's House has done, that I think is unusual, unusually extreme, is they've taken the pastor. Originally, it was preached like this. They were going to restore the dignity of the local church because that had been lost. And the authority of the pastor was a big part of that. But they have taken everything that you can name in the New Testament in terms of having authority, and he's the pastor. Also, it doesn't matter that it says elder, it's the pastor. These are qualifications for pastor. You know, there are no apostles anymore, except they say our apostle Layman Mitchell, that has come up. But there are for no other apostles, and prophets also not, except for the pastors can also prophesy. Evangelist is legit, but they're mostly failed pastors who've been brought back, and now they're evangelists as well. Now, there are no ministries other than the pastor. It's all rolled into one, you know, and that makes their authority very concentrated. The board of elders is appointed by the pastor. Where you go, you know?
Yeah, that's the way it was for us too. The pastor was basically the head honcho, and there wasn't much outside. What was funny is in our group they would preach fivefold ministry, and it was always a onefold ministry. there really wasn't anything outside of it, because in our case the prophet, who was the central figure, he had died, so there was only onefold ministries. But what I've noticed is a lot of the groups that emerge from the fivefold ministry doctrine, they all tend to have a unique onefold perspective, but they'll still talk about the different offices and preach it like that. But in the case of Wayman Mitchell, his apostleship was basically the central figure of the group, right?
Yeah. Yeah, they started calling him that. He didn't call himself that. They started calling him that, I think, about 10 years before he died. Oh, yeah. His son has taken over and has come up with a whole series of videos to be shown in the churches for Sunday morning Bible study, actually, where he's really retold the history a little different than the way it happened. But he's clearly glorifying and building the mythology for so it goes on.
Yeah, and that's another common thing among all of them. They have what's called the prophetic history. You have to know just as much about the leader and how the group formed as you do the Bible. And in some cases, it actually takes precedence over the Bible, which is funny and sad at the same time. But once that history kind of gets transmitted in a way that it can no longer go forward, they will invent a new history or rewrite the histories or change the histories. What would you say are the biggest revisions that are made in the history right now?
They stumbled into a lot of things in the beginning, but now it's told more like it was, insight and guidance. I remember that Wayman used to preach that Bible school, he did go to life. Bible school doesn't make a preacher. Bible school, he actually talked really down on it, really bad about it. He said he learned more from his Columbia Book Club, all the free books and business books, than he did about it from Bible school. And that's kind of the approach he went with the churches. Yeah, it was an organization.
So let's talk a bit about what it looks like whenever a person starts to come to terms with the fact that they're going to leave the group. What was that like for you when you first started to realize that something was a bit off? And what was it that you found that was the thing that made you decide you're going to leave?
Yeah, that's a kind of a rough question. I was sick a lot. I mean, I went through 4 years of interferon treatments. That stuff, it actually has murder and suicide as possible side effects. It was experimental when I started it, and it burned up my nervous system really bad. I've been a pain patient for the last 20 years, and I have problems with my hearing as well. So I'm in the hospital thinking about what's going on. And I had, okay, I'll back up a bit. When I was in the Gulf War, I spent practically my whole time in Saudi Arabia wondering how it was possible that Pastor Mitchell or Ron Jones, another pastor, he was the one in Colorado Springs, my first one, how either of them could be so wrong that they split, because the first split was my old pastor left. And I had just left his church like 6 months earlier, and now I'm in the Gulf War. and I spent my time wondering what's going on here. And I ended up not leaving for lack of proof that I should, but specifically when you asked, I got better. At the end, I had cancer even, and I had to have an operation, but I got better. And I went to visit a friend of mine who had gotten sick. And he had been in the church in the Netherlands since 83. He was actually from Ghana. And we were both English speakers. I can speak Dutch, but we're both native English. And he died. That was the last time I saw him alive. But he started talking to me about, we've fallen so far. And he started talking about how he used to be in the church. And I mean, it broke me up because everything he said was true. You know, I couldn't deny anything. And it's like he put words to what I was feeling, but I was trying to avoid facing. And that started the ball rolling for me. And it was, that's when I got really hyper alert about people leaving, you know. And I had a friend, I talked to him almost every Sunday. And suddenly he was gone. Him and his wife and their four kids were gone. So I got a hold of him and I found out what had happened. It's kind of typical. You know, the pastor didn't want to listen to anything else other than his thing, you know, and they left. Yeah. No, there's no openness to anything but their own chain of command.
You know, and I think that's one of the reasons why they put such boundaries of critical thinking around you, because I have to believe that over time, whenever one of the groups learns what happens whenever somebody leaves, and they watch the way that that circle of friends, they all see what happens, and they will often go ask questions, what happened? Well, once they ask questions and realize there's something wrong here, then that family leaves and the next family leaves. Yeah. So over time, you have to silence the questions. And that's exactly what happened whenever I started asking them to my grandfather, who was leading the Branham Tabernacle. He did not want the questions, and the questions were actually more important than the answers to him. Let's stop the questions. Let's not. They have answers. They're very critical to the movement, but we cannot let the questions out of the bag. And I'm not the kind to keep things in a bag.
Yeah, I know of one case, a woman whom I've known for since '82, actually, and she started having questions about Andrew Womack. She wanted to know, you know, so she goes to the pastor about that. The pastor doesn't know anything because, you know, he doesn't know anything. So he called Mitchell, and Mitchell said, kick her out. And she was asking questions about, you know, that, kick her out. So like in Arizona, he tells the guy in Zola to kick a woman out of the church in another church, you know, like an hour drive from there. He didn't even know her, but it's for asking questions.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, silencing the question, that is the most important part for many of these groups. So you're able to finally understand something's wrong and you started to leave. What happened after that? For me, that was actually was the most difficult part, because once you leave, you're suddenly faced with the fact, well, where do we go? What church do we attend? Who do we see? And for me, it was like, I don't know if you have seen the movie Dances with Wolves. They had so scared of that grass, man, because you didn't know what was in that grass, right? All the Native Americans coming up and they might take your scalp. That's kind of what I felt in my gut. I didn't know where to go. I felt like we were indoctrinated to believe all of the other churches were infected by the devil. And so I looked at it much like I did the grass in Dances with Wolves. And I came to realize that on the other side of that grass were some really, really good people, but it took me a long time to get there. What happened when you first left?
Well, when I first left, I never decided to leave. I just left. It was like in the moment. And I never went back. But when I realized what I'd done, I got a newspaper and started looking for churches in town, because I didn't know where to go. I didn't know what was there, because we didn't have anything to do with anybody. The fellowship has nothing to do with anybody. They don't work together. When they have, they regret it, kind of thing. So I started looking, and I started running. I followed Torben Sundergaard for a long time on YouTube. I watched Curry Blake a little bit on YouTube for a while. But I ended up, ran into just a local home Bible study group. And we kind of, it took a little while to figure this out, but we started studying the Bible. We read through entire books, at a time, you know, until next week. And we went through Paul's letters again, and we're in John now, but that's what I started doing. And now I'm in like more than one of these, but yeah, just studying the Bible. That's all.
And that's kind of the same journey I have. I've mentioned I read the Bible over and over and over again. I did attend some Bible studies, and I had some interesting experiences there too, because some of the churches we went to afterwards, you could tell that they were heavily influenced by some of the things that I had left. And so I came to experience both positive and negative. I did learn a lot. But going back to the Bible as the root, I think, was the key, because I started to notice, even in the groups that we started attending new different churches and different groups, I started to notice the things that I felt were in alignment with what I was reading in the Bible, and I could easily discern what wasn't. And it was just simply by reading. I didn't have to go through any difficult exercises. So after you go through that and you start connecting to the small groups, the next thing that hit me, and I'm interested to hear your experience, I suddenly went from the feeling that I had with the Dances of Wolves Grass to suddenly now there are so many more Christians in the world than I thought was possible, because we had this isolationist mentality. Did your group have that same mentality where you were the elite, the elect, and everybody else was the apostate?
Everybody else that feels that way is wrong, but we were right. Definitely. The elitist thing is, it's so unbiblical, but it is so prevalent. You know, along with gossip. Gossip is also very, very prevalent, because everybody's talking about people who aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing. You know, so yeah, that elitism is really, really strong. And I didn't know, I measured things wrong, and I started seeing that people who were marginal Christians were actually very good. They had more Christ-like character than I do, you know, and I'm working on it, but it's not, you know, they seem farther along. I don't know how long they've been at it, but I've been at it a long time. It's like, yeah, I missed the boat in that regard. And a lot of people were right and didn't even make a big deal out of it.
Yeah, I know exactly what that feeling is. So whenever I left, I started having people saying, John's just trying to create a following. And the people who know me, they just kind of laugh at it, because I'm the opposite mentality. I would run screaming from a following. But it's more than that. I left and I came to realize that I know nothing. I know absolutely nothing. No. I'm starting over from scratch. If you're following me, you're going to follow somebody who is just learning. Why don't you learn yourself? That's my mentality. And so I've kind of changed the platform over time to bring people in like you who can talk through their experiences, because I feel that everybody can learn from everybody else's experiences, and we can all kind of grow at the same time.
I learned a lot from you, though. I mean, the things that I grew up with and I didn't know they were connected, you know, and I discovered a lot of connections, even with what, you know, the fellowship, through the things that you were, you've been talking about. I tell you the truth, I try to limit myself to two of your podcasts per day, because it gets to you a bit.
I can't imagine how anybody would listen to one of me a day and not go crazy.
Yeah, but I understand too. I like to be the guy behind the curtain that nobody sees. You know, I don't like to be out front. And personally, in terms, I have a lot of my own thoughts, you know, my own ideas, but I might be wrong. And I don't want to mislead anybody, you know. I think that's a big deal. Yeah, I don't want to be part of it.
Yeah, I'm very much the same way. I think it's an IT mentality. We like to be in the back corner and everybody else can go at the coffee machine, talk to each other. We're over working. And what's interesting is I'm that type of personality, but I'm out front doing the podcast, so I'm out of my element just a bit.
Yeah.
If you could give some advice to people who are, you know, either in Potter's House or in something similar, and they're trying to break through that first step after you leave and you're trying to find your footing, what advice would you give them and how to find your footing?
Well, okay, you have to read the Bible. I mean, the Holy Spirit is in the Bible. You know, that's where you, that's where you actually find your reference points and you become oriented. But you really have to find other Christians. You got to find somebody around. And I know it's hard to avoid cults because it's everywhere and crazy, crazy doctrines. I have to watch what I say because people think sometimes that I'm talking about crazy stuff. That's not what I mean. Yeah. I do know that we have caused some people to leave the Potter's House. I feel very good about that. It includes pastors. I feel very good about that. But it's the evidence is there. You know, it's just there. And when you really look at it, that's you can't deny it. It's not the same thing as the Bible talks about. It's not. They misrepresent God.
And you mentioned, before we got on the call, you mentioned some resources for people who are thinking about leaving the Potter's House. What are the best resources you could recommend?
Okay, first of all, I would recommend, it's called Leaving the Potter's House. It's a Facebook page. I'm one of the admins. There's like 3,000 of us all over the world. Australia, there's been a lot of stuff going down with the Potter's House in Australia. The States, Europe, we also have a lot of links in Dutch, because, yeah, that's where we are. That's the best. We also have this book, which, my son is the author, but it's actually an anthology. There were 10 of us from that Facebook page that contributed chapters to this. It's also in Dutch. Yeah, but this book, which is recently come into reprint. This is Potter's House's own book. This is their very first book. They have many books that have come out since, but this was one, it was almost mimeograph, the original. It was definitely, but it's out again now. And this tells from their perspective before it went haywire. And if you read this, they don't want you reading this. They're not like that anymore. It's something else now. But yeah, that's them.
And I always forget to do this. I'm glad I remembered this time. For the listeners who are on Spotify or Apple who can't see the book you held up, can you read the title and give the name
of
the author?
Well, the Escaping the Potter's House is the name of the book. It says, an anthology of memoirs by former members. And the author is Joel E. Crosby. That's my son.
Okay.
Yeah. It's real. You know, if you read just the first two chapters, mine and his, it's going to blow your mind. The way they were messing with us. You know, seriously trying to split my son off, you know, to completely have nothing to do with me, you know, and I hadn't done anything. They didn't even tell me that they considered me to be a rebel. You know, they called me their friend. And then this stuff went down because I caught somebody in a lie. It's just not changed. That's the bad part. Still the same.
Yeah, it's so sad. I know families that are just severed and they may never get back together because of the way the cult has broken the families apart. And it's just so sad. No matter what cult you're in, you should, if you're in a group that is teaching Jesus Christ and the Bible and the gospel, it should bring families together and there should not be a place where it's bringing families apart.
Yeah. I have a daughter still in, and that's the turbulence in our family actually is because, you know, we still have one in. But that's been improving as well. You know, she even said leaving was good for you. You know, she can see that it's done me and my wife and my son also a great deal of good. Yeah, it's gotta go, gotta leave it. You know, it won't do you any good. It's a waste of time to be in that. And hopefully, you know, there's some people out there that are trying to be more Christ-like that you can run into and hang out with them.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. This has been fun. And I'm going to be digging into it deeper here soon. So hopefully I'll have some more information. But if you're listening and you're part of this group and you want to share your story, you're welcome to contact me on the website and join. But thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks. I'm happy to do it. And thanks for your stuff, too, because seriously, I didn't know this stuff. I didn't know it, you know, and I grew up in it. I was raised in it, you know, and it's like, whoa. And I can see, I recognize the truth of what you're saying, you know.
I've only skimmed the surface of all of the rabbit trails that I intend to go down, so. Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information or to share your story, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.